Welcome to New Mexico in Focus, the podcast, for Monday, March 11th, 2024. I'm senior producer Lou DeVizio. New Mexico State Land Office will withhold lease sales indefinitely on its most promising areas for oil and natural gas development in the Permian Basin. The Associated Press's Morgan Lee reports the decision comes in response to the state legislature once again failing to increase top-tier royalty rates. Bills to raise the state's top royalty rate have repeatedly stalled in the Democratic-led legislature, including this year. This year's proposal would have pushed it up from 20% to 25%. Those in favor of that change point across our eastern border to neighboring Texas, which already charges up to 25% on state trust land. In New Mexico, royalty payments from oil and gas developments are rolled into state income, deposited into a multi-billion dollar investment trust that benefits public schools, universities, and hospitals. New Mexico Oil and Gas Association CEO Missy Currier says the disagreement between the legislature and the state land office threatens to penalize petroleum producers and public beneficiaries as they pause new leases. Also across our eastern border, in Texas, last week, our neighbors reached an unwelcome landmark, the state's largest ever wildfire. As that happened, we wanted to check in on where things stand as residents of northern New Mexico try to recover from the Hermit's Peak Calf Canyon fire, which set the grim milestone of largest ever for our state in 2022. To do that, we partnered up with Patrick Lohman of Source New Mexico, who's written dozens of stories about Hermit's Peak Calf Canyon. You probably know that fire began as a pair of botched prescribed burns on federal forest land in San Miguel County. Patrick spent all of last year in the burn scar, partnering with ProPublica to try to answer a single question in the wildfire's aftermath. When the government makes a mistake, what will it do to make things right for those it harmed? Patrick invited two guests, both featured in recent pieces from Source and ProPublica, who are reluctant experts in that question. Both suffered losses in the wildfire or the floods that followed. Both are trying to file claims for what they're owed from a $4 billion compensation fund, and both have become de facto leaders in their communities helping their neighbors find a way forward. Kate Peck writes a weekly column about the recovery for the Las Vegas Optic, and Yolanda Cruz moderates a private Facebook page that's become a vital resource for those trying to rebuild. Patrick asks them both what they've lived through and what advice they have for our Texas neighbors as they prepare for a long and painful recovery.
Thank you both for coming down south to talk with us today, and welcome to New Mexico in Focus.
Thank you, Patrick. I
was hoping we could start with you both sharing your experiences of the fire and floods and telling us where things stand for you now. Yolanda, you had some losses in the fire and are also helping your parents navigate the FEMA bureaucracy. What did the fire take from you, and how close are you to being able to be fully compensated?
The fire crossed our complete acreage. We have 10 acres in San Miguel County, and we were able to watch that on the satellite maps, not real time, but the heat maps showed the fire crossing the entirety of our property. We were really unsure what we would come back to, and when we returned, all of the ground was black. Some of the trees were completely gone closer to the house. Up above, about probably 40 to 50 feet from the house, was the high severity burn. And I think it was miraculous that it did not take our home, because as the sparks fly, we lost many homes on that private road that we live on, even where the trees were not as damaged. And so before we left, we had about 8 hours notice that we were going to evacuate. So we wet down our home, we wet our decks, we raked. And I think that's what helped save it, because the fire went right up to that point on the ground. Besides the trees, we lost, we had damages to our well, we had damages to our septic system, to our water storage system. We lost equipment, our wood splitter. We lost some vehicles that we were unable to take out, a lot of tools and different equipment, and a carport garage that we had there. And so, you know, of course, fencing, all of those things. My granddaughter also had a little play area from when she was younger. And so a lot of those things were completely gone. There was one, I think, a little playhouse. And I thought, something's missing there. And I went to check. There was not even a pile of ashes, nothing. It was just gone. It just disintegrated. So it was really surprising to see the damages, and we were one of the lucky ones.
Yeah.
The flooding came through, and that damaged the culvert over the Arroyo Huar Road crosses to get home. And the water just comes from everywhere now when it rains. Before you could see, like, you know, the trickles, the streams that get created when there's some water. We're fortunate again that the mountain above us is not very high. So although there is a lot of water and we've had to protect our home, there's not the amount of water that I've seen in other places.
Yeah. And Kate, can you tell me how rebuilding is going for you?
Not. I have found, was a vagabond for about a year, different, you know, like my house was totally leveled. The foundation was still sort of standing, but the rest was a barbecue pit. That was my home of 18 years. Luckily, I got an early phone call. I was retired from the fire department and EMS, so I got a phone call, a little heads up on evacuation. So I was able to get my horse out, my animals out, and a few little things. So it took my home of 18 years and all the memorabilia of a lifetime, which is pretty precious. And I tell people, and I honestly feel this way, in a lot of ways, the woman I was died with that fire. But you go on. And I'm waiting to find out what FEMA's going to do before I can rebuild. I was one of the lucky ones. I had insurance, so I wasn't destitute. And I also had a lot of good friends that opened their homes to me. I went to help a friend briefly in Texas with a business, and while I was there, the people I was staying with got evacuated. So I got stuck in Texas for 4.5 months, living in a travel trailer. Finally got the trailer back, lived through the winter in a travel trailer. I did not intend to do that again. That's an interesting development. But you know, there's still, I've found and purchased an older single wide, so I've got a decent place to live until I can rebuild. A lot of folks don't have those benefits, so I'm grateful for that. I also lost, it's the intangibles.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it's the, I did a poem right after the fire called Memories Don't Burn. Because what has helped me through is to know that the objects did not matter for themselves. They matter because of the memories. And you can put a match to it, but you don't burn a memory.
Yeah.
So life goes on. And it's still precious. With people like Yolanda, the people, I mean, really, after the fire, I lost so much. But what I gained was knowing the true hearts of the people of the community. And how they come through for each other.
Yeah, that's beautiful. I want to stay with you. You just came back from Fritch, Texas.
Fritch, Texas, yeah.
Where you delivered supplies to those being evacuated.
Primarily, yes.
Yeah, what did you bring?
Well, we called in advance. I called the editor of the newspaper there. And the list they primarily gave us for what they needed, near as I can tell, it was equipment, primarily equipment that the crews needed going through the houses that had burned. We did have a few things, you know, some food, that sort of thing. But we did our best to meet the wish list that we got, which was like aluminum shovels and rakes and contractor bags, things like that.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, just to remind people, that's the Smokehouse Creek fire that
right.
started February 26th and has already burned.
A million acres.
Yeah. Yeah, the biggest fire in Texas history. What compelled you to help those people?
Well, I grew up on a ranch in the Texas Panhandle.
Yeah.
So it's the old stomping ground. And I just wanted to, people help me, I wanted to help people.
Yeah.
You know, so I volunteered to make the trip just to take what we could.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Yolanda, speaking with Texas, Texas Power Company said today it believes that its facilities have been involved in an ignition for that fire. Now, a power company is different from a government entity, and no two disasters are exactly the same. But if that company is deemed liable, someone will have to make choices about how to compensate survivors of this fire. I'm just wondering, what lessons could the overseers of whoever runs that fund in Texas learn from what FEMA did here with this compensation fund?
FEMA is really the wrong organization or agency to handle these funds. There have been fires started by power companies in other states such as California, and they do not have FEMA overseeing that fund distribution. And so they need to model that process instead of looking for a government organization. We know that government runs very slowly, and it seems as if FEMA is running even slower than most government organizations.
Yeah, they have recently promised to move more quickly. They've brought in more claims adjusters. Is there anything about the way the fund could be structured? Do you have any thoughts on this about, you know, something that FEMA did right or did wrong that might go better in Texas when we get to that point, which could be years, of course. But
you know, first off, I want to say that they have a lot of local people working for FEMA and very good people. A lot of good friends work there, and they have good hearts and they know the communities. But they're not the ones making the decisions. And so when you have people making decisions about what to compensate and how to compensate, and they don't know the area, then they're not making good decisions. And so FEMA is saying, we've never done something like this before. We've never compensated for everything before. And it took them so long to come up with the final rules. And even though they have the final rules in place, they're still making changes. And so those with complex cases, like those who lost more than maybe trees or have more than smoke damage, are still waiting for compensation. While people who had less damages, especially right now, FEMA just announced a few weeks ago that they would be covering smoke damage for people in Las Vegas, say, and that is not in the footprint of the fire. While I'm glad that they're acknowledging there are more damages, those claims are able to be paid out more quickly because they're simpler claims adjusted on the square footage of a home. And so when people in Las Vegas are getting paid quickly, and people who lost homes, like Kate, have still not seen a dollar, there's something wrong with the process.
Yeah. Well, I understand that today a small group of advocates and fire survivors are in Washington, D.C., seeking meetings with our congressional delegation to ask for some changes. You decided to join us instead of going with them, so thank you for that. But if you did have a chance to sit down with Senator Ben Ray Lujan, for example, what's the most urgent problem you'd ask him to fix?
I think one of the most urgent problems is, of course, again, those who were most deeply impacted should be prioritized. Second off is that when Angela Gladwell was the director, she, again, does not know the state. And the community has been asking since we knew that FEMA was going to administer the funds for a local administrator to come on and work with communities. That has not happened. And that's what's being asked again. I know that I don't know that that would be happening. They did open up the position. And so I think that was open for 7 days.
Yeah, we'll absolutely talk about that shortly. I just wanted to give you a chance, Kate. What's the most urgent problem you think Congress, our congressional delegation, could fix?
Yeah. Two levels.
Yeah.
Number one, I don't buy. I worked in the Navy. I don't buy the red tape excuse. And that's what we keep getting. That and they're slow at allocating funds. Also, like the recent check, they finally came up with a checklist of what you had to have, which is unreasonable. Expecting if you want compensation for your expenses when you evacuated, and they want gas receipts from 2 years ago. At the recent town hall meeting, there was one gentleman who had personal property damages, but also had his business, and he said that he had turned in tax forms, federal tax forms, legal document, showing the business losses. FEMA wanted 3 years of check stubs. I would say at both levels, both locally, what they're doing with the claims office right now, and in general, I think the disaster response system is broken. and needs to be totally reevaluated. There is I just found out about that from the upper echelon of the administration. I don't know if it's within FEMA or above that, but there is a new pending final, interim final rule for how they handle individual assistance. And when I read the executive summary of that, basically I think it said that they need to get away from the assumption that people who have had a disaster are trying to defraud the government and therefore must provide whatever documentation that is required of them, and it's been rather arbitrary from case to case, have to provide that to prove that they deserve to be helped. It needs to be reversed, where if FEMA turns down someone who has requested help, they need to give verifiable reasons why they don't provide that help. I mean, it's flawed in its very essence. And I'm hoping that this indicates, I don't know that we'll see it. You know, there's a 180-day response period. The public can respond to that interim final rule. So I don't know that we'll see the benefit, or if we do, it may be belatedly. But I'm hoping that part of, because we have spoken out as a people, largely. And I'm hoping that, yes, that helps us. But even more so, there's going to be millions of people with climate change. It's going to continue to be a problem.
Yeah.
And if we can raise our voices a little bit and it helps to rectify that, then we will raise our voices and help to rectify that.
As of March 6th, FEMA had paid about 11% of the nearly $4 billion fund to compensate victims. That number is continuing to rise, and FEMA notes that those payouts account for 68% of all claims submitted with documentation. But attorneys representing more than 1,000 claimants have filed at least 14 separate lawsuits against FEMA. They allege the agency has missed legal deadlines to provide payment offers and that it's refusing to pay for intangible losses and emotional harms that those northern New Mexico communities have suffered, they say, in violation of federal law. FEMA is challenging that contention in court. Meanwhile, on the ground, community groups are calling on the agency to replace the claims office director with someone who understands New Mexico better. Now back to Pat with Yolanda and Kate for part two of their conversation.
Thanks, Lou. Kate, FEMA announced in mid-January it was, quote, consolidating, end quote, its disaster response across New Mexico. And as part of that, reassigning the former director of the claims office. Who do you hope takes over the so-called joint recovery office?
From everything that I have seen in you know, similar cases have usually gone through the courts because it's an electric company or something like that. And there has been a request from the very beginning after the legislature passed these funds to use a retired judge, someone who is accustomed to how you distribute money compensating people for damages. And I know there have been groups that have submitted lists of qualified retired judges here within the state. I also think that we put in a request during the public comment period to have local people represented, and they have hired local people. But as Yolanda pointed out, they're not in decision-making positions. My hope would be that they select a retired judge who is experienced in this sort of thing. I know I did a little reading about how the PG&E in California, that huge fire when the electric company took responsibility for it. The timeline, once it was adjudicated and then put into place, went fairly quickly. It was a very good system, but it was done because it was headed by a retired judge who knows the system. So I don't know why FEMA felt like they needed to, you know, they've kind of, I think, largely organized their response against what they've used with the Stafford Act, the way FEMA normally distributes or works with, disaster after a big fire, distributing Stafford Act funds. But again, that means that in this case, even though it was at fault of the federal government, that same thinking of people have to prove that they deserve it based on whatever FEMA wants to demand, that's been in place. That was inappropriate. That was entirely inappropriate. It continues to be, and a lot of people suffer because of it.
Just given what you were saying about, you know, what you see as the culture of FEMA about making people prove their losses, do you think one person, even if it is a former judge from New Mexico who knows New Mexico law and culture, can make a difference in the direction of the office? Do you think it can really be one person.
I think it can.
Yeah.
I don't think that because we're so far along in the process, I don't know that it could be a total solution. Mm-hmm. But you know what? Anything's better than what we've experienced, especially for those who are devastated. People who are living with family or living in trailers. The Long Range Planning Group, I remember at one time, I was on that committee for a while. And I left after one specific case that still troubles me. It was being FEMA advised. It wasn't a FEMA committee, but it was being FEMA advised. And I saw the paperwork, FEMA wanting to use some of the same criteria to determine if people get help as if it were actually FEMA money. And there was a gentleman that needed $500 to build an outhouse because his family was living in tents. And my response was, give him the money. Forget all the paperwork they wanted. This man, they're living in tents, give him the money. And that was easy to prove. You go look. Mm-hmm. You know, that's a 30-minute drive and a look and see that, okay, they need it. Give them the money. So I don't know if I answered that. Yes, I think it's making a difference. I don't think it'll be a total solution.
Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. Yolanda, I understand you had some concerns about the way the claims office advertised the new director of this office. What about the process set off alarm bells for you?
What set off alarm bells was that it was only advertised for 7 days. You know, usually when there's a job opening, people really need to get that out widely. There's also a need to look at your resume and update it and kind of tailor it to the position that's open and your letter of interest. And so to me, 7 days is very minimal time for that. I know that there is no standard time, but it is very minimal.
Yeah, and we've reached out to FEMA, and just for what it's worth, they said that this was an emergent position that needed to be hired quickly, and that they shared it widely with state officials and on their Facebook page. I wanted to ask you about Facebook. You're the moderator of a Facebook group that has about 13,000 members, last I checked, maybe more. Many of them are fire survivors. I just was hoping you could kind of take the pulse of that group, of that community, for a minute. And tell me what changes you're seeing, you know, over the long course of this disaster. Like, what has changed, and ultimately, are people getting more frustrated, less frustrated? What would you say about the long view of that?
So there was a lot of anger at the beginning, which is understandable because the federal government should have known better. Everyone who lives in the area knows you don't light fires on windy days. You don't light fires in dry conditions, and so. There's been a lot of anger over the course of this over the course of the fire, and when FEMA first came in, the most that they were kind of well, not the most, but at first what they were helping with was about $500. Sometimes it was a little over that if they could see that you know there was something more that needed to happen, but $500 to somebody who's had substantial damages is nothing. And when you're hearing from elected officials, from the president down, don't worry, the government will take care of this, you'll be fully compensated. And that's what the expectation was. And even people who were donating to the survivors thought, oh, there's not a need now because the government is doing this. Mm-hmm. And so there was a lot of re-education that needed to happen to say the government is not taking care of this right now. There's a long time before we will see anything. Now there's a lot of people who have withdrawn their claims from FEMA because they're being almost audited, right? When you're asked to bring in receipts that you may not have, tax returns from 3 years. If you don't have receipts, you're asked to bring in bank statements and credit card bills. And it just is really traumatic for people who have experienced so much trauma already. To be felt like you're being called a liar and a thief and a cheat each time that you're interacting with the office. And again, this is the policies that they've enacted. And so there's a lot of anger. There are people who've just thrown in the towel. Wow. And I think that's what's going to happen. I think that people who can afford to wait it out will wait it out, and those that can't will probably leave the county. We've been losing population now for over 10 years, and many people are deeply rooted in the communities. And it's tough to be there with so much destruction, but it's even worse when you're not getting the help that was promised.
Yeah. Speaking of, Kate, you recently attended yet another funeral for a fire survivor, Ray Herrera, who died before being able to return home. I spoke to him a few times myself, and I know he was getting very frustrated. Like he once told me that, quote, FEMA wouldn't know how to pour water out of a boot, even with instructions written on the heel.
That's right.
Did you hear that one?
No, that sounds like right.
And so this is the second funeral you've personally attended, maybe more, of someone who's unable to, actively trying to rebuild, who's unable to move back home. What has this prolonged recovery done to the community you love?
It's shown the depth of the hurt. It's shown that the people, no matter what the situation is, in general, the people make good decisions. One of the things that I have been frustrated hearing from FEMA, and I don't put up with it anymore, is the condescending attitude towards the people. People in more in San Miguel County and that little piece of Taos that burned, they are not stupid people, but they're being treated like they are. But I think I want to point out, it's disheartening. You know, there's a lot of the services that are provided are mental health that come through. But I want to point something out, because our community has not waited for FEMA to get off its posterior. There are things happening. There's a group called Neighbors Helping Neighbors. I remember the day it formed. It was in that shelter the first night after big evacuations. And it was chaos. People were bringing stuff in. People were coming in. It was chaos. I saw a group of maybe five women stand in a circle, talk about what was needed, and within an hour they created order. Yeah. That's the local people with no preparation whatsoever. And then that organization, it became Neighbors Helping Neighbors, which continues to this day to serve the people. They now are advocates that, you know, there's philanthropic funds that haven't been widely dispersed yet. But because of Neighbors Helping Neighbors creating an advocacy program, now people are getting, I got some help from them to put in a slab so I can take a travel trailer out to my property. And so people can go to Neighbors Helping Neighbors and you're gonna get help. Quickly. They still make a case for it. They have to show that this is what is needed and why, but it's happening. I know I work with a group called Collaborative Visions in Mora County, which is trying to work on creating long-term solutions. There's an innovative project that started called Plaza Nueva that, amongst other things, is going to eventually replaced the plaza that Mora lost in 1847 in the Second Battle of Mora. The local people, we don't need FEMA to tell us what to do. We need FEMA to disperse money that has been designated by the legislature, by the president, to help people regain their lives again. They don't need to be telling us what to do.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I just was hoping that we could end this with you both taking about a minute to describe if you ever allowed yourself a vision of a fully compensated, a fully restored community, just what you picture when you think about a community that's fully compensated for this terrible mistake. We can start with you, Kate.
The Norteños, the people, whatever, Hispanic, Indigenous, Anglo, there's a long history of being resilient. We're not going to be the same. But I do believe firmly that the people of this community, because of their grit, their determination, their intelligence, we're going to build back. I did some consulting in Puerto Rico, and I love their slogan, Build Back Better. And I think there's going to be some people that have to give up. There's going to be some people who aren't going to live to see it. But we're going to build back better. It better be with FEMA, and it better be with the funds that have been designated to help. But we'll be back.
Glad to hear it. Yolanda, do you want to share your vision for what
Yes.
it could look like? Yeah.
The beauty of the area will always be scarred by this fire, but the beauty also exists in the people who are there. And there are so many efforts, including our local colleges and different community groups, as Kate mentioned, that are looking at economic development. You know, how do we change things? How do we bring in more skills? The FEMA contracts that will be awarded to help rebuild, a lot of the smaller contractors don't have what's needed, the licensing or maybe insurance or other things, bookkeepers, things like that that are needed. So they're trying to help now build that capacity. So I believe that the community is coming together and will find ways to bring more strength and look at what opportunities may exist and just be a stronger community because of that.
All right, well, thank you so much for all of your time and your expertise. It's been invaluable to me as I've reported on this issue, and as you can expect, I'll call you both again soon. Okay. So,
thank you, Patrick.
Thank you.
Thank you.
FEMA has set up several ways people can get help with their claims, and those include a helpline. That number is 505-995-7133. The agency has also opened claims offices in Santa Fe, Mora, and Las Vegas, New Mexico. We have a link with their specific locations and hours under this story on our website and social media pages. If you'd like to apply for free flood insurance, FEMA sent a reminder last week letting people know the deadline to apply for that through the claims office is April 1st. As for Pat's work with ProPublica's Byard Duncan, you can read their story about Yolanda and other fire survivors in this week's Santa Fe Reporter, featuring a series of poignant portraits by photojournalist Adria Malcolm. You'll soon be able to read Kate's column online at sourcenm.com, and I've also included a link in the description of this podcast episode. Now, one story I couldn't include on the podcast this week comes from Our Land's Laura Paskus. It's so visually engaging that putting it up here in audio form wouldn't do it any justice. But right now, on the Our Land YouTube page, you can watch Laura take you to the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service's annual Mexican wolf count in Apache Creek. Our cameras follow the group of biologists tasked with recording those numbers as they collect the information they need to protect and monitor the endangered species. Again, that's on Our Land's YouTube page and on the PBS app. Thanks for listening to the podcast this week. Be sure to follow along with us on our social media pages during the week. That's Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. You can give us feedback or just stay up to date as we post previews and news items leading up to our show on Friday night. Thanks again, everyone. I'm Senior Producer Lou DeVizio for Monday, March 11th, 2024. This is New Mexico in Focus, the podcast. Have a great week, everyone.